that Kayode shared with him, about the Patriots and the true colors of Razor, about Eden, then Congress's determination to oust the elector, everything I'd discovered, and then some. My head was in a fog when we bolted from the room and made our way up to the hospital roof. Now, after the cold outside air and the speed of Kayode's air maneuver, I can calculate details a little more clearly. "We're closing in on the war front," Kayode says. The instant those words come out of her mouth, I hear the distant sound of explosions. They're muffled, but we must be thousands of feet in the air, and I can still feel the shock each time they go off. There's a sudden lift, and I press into my seat. She's trying to push the jet as high as it can go, so we don't get shot out of the sky by ground missiles. I force myself to take deep, calming breaths as we continue to climb. My ears pop endlessly. I watch as Kayode falls into formation with a squadron of colonies jets. "We're gonna need to break from them soon," she mutters. There's pain in her voice, probably from her gunshot wound. "Hang tight." "Day?" I manage to call out. I don't hear anything, and for a second I think he blacked out. Then he replies, "Still here." He sounds detached, like he's fighting to stay conscious. "Denver's a few minutes away," Kayode says. We stabilize again. When I peer out of the cockpit down at the pockets of clouds far below us, I catch my breath. Airships, easily more than 150, as far as the eye can see, dot the sky like miniature daggers soaring through the air, stretching in lines off into the horizon. The colony ships all have a distinct gold stripe down the middle of their runways that we can see even from way up here. Not far in front of them is a wide strip of empty airspace, where sparks of light and smoke fly back and forth, and on the other side are rows of airships I can recognize. Republic ships, marked with a blood-red star on the side of each hull. Jets are raging in dogfights all over the place. We must be a good 500 feet above them, but I'm not sure if that's a safe enough distance. An alarm on Kaede's control board beeps. A voice rings out in the cockpit. "Pilot, you are not cleared for this area," it says. Male, colony's accent. "This is not your squadron. You are ordered to land on Descon 9 immediately." "Negative," Kayode replies. She pulls our jet up and keeps climbing. "Pilot, you are ordered to land on Descon 9 immediately." Kayode turns off her mic for an instant and looks back at us. She seems a little too happy about our situation. "Gotti Talker's following us," she says in a mock authoritative tone. "We got too hot on our tail." Then she flips the mic on again and replies brightly, "Negative, Descon. I'm gonna shoot you out of the sky." The person in the other plane sounds shocked and angry this time. "Change course and get this one." Kayode lets out an ear-piercing shout. "Spit the sky, boys!" She rockets us forward and up at blinding speed, then goes into a spin. Streaks of light shoot past the cockpit window. The two jets tailing us must have gotten close enough to open fire. I feel my stomach drop as Kayode goes into a sudden nosedive, killing our engine in the process. We drop at a pace that turns my vision black and white. I feel myself fading away. An instant later, I jolt awake. I must have blacked out. We're falling. We're plummeting to the earth. The airships below us grow in size. It looks like we're heading straight at the deck of one of them. No, we're going way too fast. We'll be smashed into pieces. More streaks of light rush past us. The jets following are diving after us. Then, without warning, Kayode fires the engines again. They roar to life. She pulls back hard on the lever, and the whole jet spins in a half circle, so the nose is facing up again. I'm almost sucked into my chair at the sudden change. My vision blacks out again, and this time I have no idea how much time has passed. A few seconds? Minutes? I realize we're charging back up into the sky. The other jets zoom down. They're trying to pull up, but it's too late. Behind us, a huge explosion shakes us hard in our seats. The jets must have struck the deck of the airship with the force of a dozen bombs. Orange and yellow fire churns upward from one of the colony's ships. We're now zooming across the empty airspace between the two countries, and Kayode sends us into another spin that saves us from a barrage of fire. We cross the airspace and cut through the sky over the Republic's airships. One lone colony's jet, lost in the chaos. I gape at the scene outside, wondering if the Republic is confused that the colonies attacked one of their own jets. If anything, that's what bought us enough time to cross the warfront space.
Best split S you've ever seen, I bet, Kaede says with a laugh.
It sounds more strained than usual. Not far from us now are the looming towers of Denver and its forbidding armor shrouded in a permanent sea of smog and haze. Behind us, I hear the first sounds of gunfire as Republic jets start tailing us in an attempt to shoot us down.
How are we going to get inside?
Day shouts as Kaede spins the jet, sends a missile backward, and pushes us to go faster.
I'll get us in, she shouts back.
We can't make it if we go overhead, I reply. The armor has missiles lining every side of that wall. They'll shoot us down before we ever get across into the city.
No city's impenetrable.
Kaede sends the jet lower, even as the Republic jets continue to pursue us.
I know what I'm doing.
We're closing in fast on Denver. I can see the looming gray walls of the armor rising up before us, a barricade like nothing else in the Republic, and the heavy gray pillars, each 100 feet apart from the next, lining its sides. I close my eyes. No way. No way Kaede can get us over that. A squadron of jets could get over, maybe, and even then, it'll be a long shot. I picture a missile hitting us, and our seats ejecting us out over the city skies, the shots they'll fire up at our parachutes, our bodies plummeting to the ground. The armor is close now. They must have seen us approaching for a while, and their weapons will be trained on us. I bet they've never seen a rogue colony's jet before. Then, Kaede dives. Not just any dive. She's headed down at almost 90 degrees, ready to send us smashing into the earth. Behind me, Day sucks in his breath. The buildings below rush up at us.
She's lost control of the jet. I know it. We've been hit.
At the last second, Kaede pulls up. We skim above the buildings at mach speed, so close that the roofs seem like they're going to rip the bottom right off our jet. Immediately, Kaede starts slowing down the jet, until we're cruising at a speed barely fast enough to keep us airborne. Suddenly, I realize what she's going to do. It's completely stupid. She's not taking us over the armor at all. She's going to try to squeeze the jet through the opening that the trains use to pass in and out of Denver. The same tunnels I'd seen when I'd taken that train ride with the Elector. Of course. The surface-to-air missile systems mounted along the armor's wall aren't designed to take down anything like us from the ground, because they can't shoot at such a low angle. And machine guns on the wall aren't powerful enough. But if Kaede doesn't aim exactly right, we'll explode against the wall and burst into flames. We're close enough for me to see soldiers running back and forth on top of the wall of the armor. Their communications must be flying fast. But it doesn't matter at this rate. One second, the armor's several hundred feet in front of us, and the next, we're hurtling toward the dark entrance of an open train tunnel.
Hold on!
Kaede shouts. She pushes the jet lower, as if that were possible. The entrance yawns at us with its gaping mouth. We're not going to make it. The tunnel is way too small. Then, we're inside, and for an instant, the tunnel's pitch black. Bright sparks burst from each end of the jet as the wings tear through the entrance's sides. A rumbling sound comes from above us. They're rushing to shut the entrance, I realize, but they're too late. Another second. We zoom out of the entrance and into Denver. Kaede slams the jet's lever the opposite way in an attempt to slow us down even more.
Pull up! Pull up!
Day yells. Buildings zip past us. We're too low to the ground and heading straight for the side of a tall barrack. Kaede veers sharply to one side. We miss the building by a hair. Then we're down. Really down. The jet slams into the ground and skids, flinging our bodies forward hard against our seatbelts. I feel like my limbs are ripping off. Civilians and soldiers alike run out of the way on either side of the street. A few sparks crack the cockpit. It's random gunfire, I realize, from shocked soldiers. Crowds line the road several blocks away from us. They gape at the jet careening across the pavement. We finally come to a halt when one of the wings catches the side of a building, sending us crashing sideways into an alley. I jerk roughly back against my seat. Our canopy pops open before I can even catch my breath. I manage to undo my seatbelt and leap dizzily up onto the edge of the cockpit.
Kaede? I'm squinting to see her and Day through the smoke. We have to... My words die on my tongue. Kaede slumped against the pilot seat, her buckle still wrapped around her. Her pilot goggles sit on top of her head. I guess she never even bothered to put them on.
Her eyes point vacantly at the buttons on her control panel. A small bloodstain soaks the front of her shirt, not far from the wound she received when we first got into the jet. One of the stray bullets had gone straight through the canopy and into her when we crash-landed. Kaede, who just minutes ago had seemed invincible. For a moment, I'm frozen. The sounds of chaos around me dull, and the smoke covers everything except me and Kaede's body strapped into the pilot seat. A small voice manages to echo through my mind, penetrating the black and white fog of numbness, a familiar, pulsing light that gets me going again. Move, it tells me. Now. I tear my eyes away, then search frantically for Day. He's not sitting in the jet anymore. I scramble onto the edge of the wing and slide down blindly through the smoke and wreckage until I hit the ground on my hands and knees. I can't see a thing. Then, through the smoke, Day rushes up to me. He pulls me to my feet. I'm suddenly reminded of the first time I'd ever seen him, materializing out of nothingness with his blue eyes and dust-streaked face, holding out his hand to me. His face is slashed with agony. He must have seen Kaede, too.
There you are. I thought you'd already gotten out,
he whispers as we stumble through the jet's wreckage.
Make for the crowd.
My legs ache. Our crash landing must have given me head-to-toe bruises. We pause underneath one of the wrecked wings just as the first soldiers rush to the jet. Half of them form a makeshift barrier to keep civilians out, their backs turned to us. Other soldiers shine lights across the smoke and twisted metal, scanning for survivors. One of them must have spotted Kaede, because he shouts something at the others and motions them over.
It's a colony's jet, he shouts, sounding incredulous. A jet made it past the armor and right into Denver.
We're temporarily hidden from view under this wing, but they'll see us any second now. The makeshift soldier barricade separates us from the crowds. All around us and throughout the city are the sounds of breaking glass, roaring fires, screaming, chanting people. Only those closest to our jet's wreckage seem to realize that a colony's jet crashed at all. I glance at where the Capitol Tower looms. Anden's voice is ringing from every city block and from every speaker. A live feed of his image must be broadcasting to every jumbotron in the city and in the nation. I look on as several furious rioters fling Molotov cocktails at the soldiers. The people have no idea that Congress is sitting back, waiting for their anger to spill enough to put Razor in Anden's place. There's no way Anden will be able to calm this crowd. I imagine the same protests sparking up across the country, in every street and city. If the Patriots had succeeded in publicly broadcasting the elector's death from the Capitol Tower's speakers, there would already have been a revolution.
Now, Day says.
We rush out from under the wing, taking the soldiers' barricade completely off guard. Before any of them can grab or shoot at us, we're through, ducking into the crowd and melting in with the people. Instantly, Day lowers his head and pulls us through the thick pockets of arms and legs. His hand is clenched fiercely around mine. My breath comes out ragged and forced, but I refuse to slow us down now. I push on. People shout in surprise as we barrel through. Behind us, the soldiers raise the alarm.
There!
One yells. A few shots ring out. They're after us. We barrel ahead through the crowd. Now and then I hear people exclaim,
Is that Day? Did Day come back in a colony's jet?
When I glance behind us, I can tell that half the soldiers are heading the wrong way, unable to tell which direction we took. A couple of others are still hot on our trail. We're only a block away from the Capitol Tower now, but to me, it seems like miles. Occasionally, I get a glimpse of it through all the bodies pushing and shoving around. The jumbotrons show Anden standing on a balcony, a tiny lone figure dressed in black and red, holding his hands out in a gesture of appeal. He needs Day's help. Behind us, four soldiers are gradually catching up. The chase saps away the last of my strength. I'm panting, struggling to breathe. Day is already slowing down to keep pace with me, but I can tell we'll never make it at this rate.
I squeeze his hand and shake my head.
You have to go ahead,
I tell Dave firmly.
You're cracked.
He purses his lips and pulls us forward faster.
We're almost there.
No.
I lean closer to him as we continue to make our way through the people.
This is our one shot. Neither of us will make it if I keep slowing us down.
Day hesitates, torn. We've already been separated once before. Now he's wondering if letting me go means he'll never see me again. But we don't have time for him to dwell on this.
I can't run fast, but I can hide in the crowd. Trust me.
Without warning, he grabs my waist, pulls me into a tight embrace, and kisses me hard on the lips. They're burning hot. I kiss him back fiercely and run my hands along his back.
I'm sorry I didn't believe you,
he breathes.
Hide. Stay safe. See you soon.
Then he squeezes my hand and vanishes. I suck in a breath of icy cold air. Move it, June. No time to waste. I stop where I am, turn around, and crouch down, right as the soldiers reach me. The first one doesn't even see me coming. One second he's running, the next, I've tripped him, and he's flat on his back. I don't dare stop to look. Instead, I stagger back into the furious crowd, weaving my way through people with my head down until the soldiers have fallen far behind. I can't believe how many people are here. Fights between civilians and street police are breaking out everywhere. Above it all, the jumbotrons display live feeds of Anden's face, his expression grave. He's pleading from behind the protective glass. 6 minutes pass. I'm only a dozen yards from the base of the Capitol Tower when I notice that the people around me are slowly falling silent. They're no longer focused on Anden.
Up there!
One person shouts. They're pointing at a boy with torch-bright hair, who's perched on a tower balcony on the opposite side of the same floor as Anden. The balcony's protective glass catches some of the street's light, and from here, the boy is glowing. I catch my breath and pause. It's Day.
Day. By the time I reach the Capitol Tower, I'm soaked in sweat. My body burns with pain. I go around to one of its sides that isn't facing the main square, and survey the crowd as people shove roughly past me in both directions. All around us are blinding jumbotrons, each displaying the exact same thing. The young elector, pleading in vain with the people to return home and stay safe, to disperse before things get out of hand. He's trying to console them by dictating his plans for reforming the Republic, doing away with the trials, and changing the way their career assignments are given. But I can tell this gaudy political talk isn't going to come close to satisfying the crowd. And even though Anden is older and wiser than June and me, he's missing that crucial piece. The people don't believe him, and they don't believe in him. I bet Congress is watching all this with delight. Razor, too. Does Anden even know that Razor was the one behind the plot? I narrow my eyes, then leap up to grab the second floor ledge of the wired building. I try to pretend that June is right behind me, cheering me on. The speakers do seem to be wired up the way Kaede had described back when we were in Lamar. I bend down at the ledge right below the rooftop to study the wires. Yep, wired in almost the same way I'd done it on the night I first met June in that midnight alley, where I'd asked her for plague cures through the speaker system. Except this time, I'll be speaking not to an alleyway, but to the Republic's entire capital. To the country! The wind stings my cheeks and whistles past my ears in gales, forcing me to constantly adjust my footing. I could die right now. I have no way of knowing if the soldiers on the rooftops will shoot me down before I can reach relative safety behind a balcony's wall of glass, dozens of feet above the rest of the crowd. Or maybe they'll recognize who I am and hold their fire. I climb until I reach the 10th floor, the same floor that the elector's balcony's on, then crouch for a second to look down. I'm high enough. The instant I turn the corner of this building, everyone will see me. The masses are most concentrated on this side, their faces turned up to the elector, their fists raised in anger. Even from here I can see how many of them have that scarlet streak painted into their hair. Apparently the Republic's attempts to outlaw it don't work so well when everyone wants to do it. On the edges of the square, street police and soldiers are striking out mercilessly with their batons, pushing people back with rows of transparent shields. I'm surprised there's no shooting. My hands start shaking in rage. There are few things as intimidating as hundreds of Republic soldiers decked out in faceless riot gear, standing in grim, dark lines against a mass of unarmed protesters. I flatten myself against the wall and take a few breaths of cold night air, struggling to stay calm. Struggling to remind myself of June and June's brother and the Elector, and that behind some of those faceless Republic masks are good people with parents and siblings and children. I hope Andon is the reason no shots have rung out, that he has told his soldiers not to fire on this crowd. I have to believe that. Otherwise, I'll never convince the people of what I'm about to say. "Don't be afraid," I whisper to myself, my eyes squeezed shut. "You can't afford it." Then I step out from the shadows, hurry along the ledge until I turn the corner of the building, and hop into the closest balcony I can find. I face the central square. The protective balcony glass cuts off about a foot over my head, but I can still feel the wind siphoning in from above. I take off my cap and toss it over the top edge. It floats down to the ground, carried sideways by the wind. My hair streams out all around me. I bend down, twist one of the speaker's wires, and hold the speaker up like a megaphone. Then I wait. At first no one notices me, but soon one face turns up in my direction, probably attracted by the brightness of my hair, and then another face, and then another. A small group. It grows into several dozen, all of them pointing up at me. The roars and angry chants below begin to subside. I wonder if June sees me. The soldiers lining other roofs have their guns fixed on me, but they don't shoot. They're stuck with me in this awkward, tense limbo. I want to run, to do what I always do, have always done, for the last 5 years of my life. Escape. Flee into the shadows. But this time, I stand my ground. I'm tired of running. The crowd grows quieter as more and more turn their faces up to see me. At first, I hear incredulous chatter, even some laughs. "That can't be Day," I imagine them muttering to one another. "Some imposter." But the longer I stay here, the louder they get. Everyone has turned toward me now. My eyes wander over to where Andon is on his balcony. Even he's looking at me now. I hold my breath, hoping that he doesn't decide to order me shot. Is he on my side? Then they're all chanting my name. "Day! Day! Day!" I can hardly believe my ears. They're chanting for me, and their voices echo down every block and reach every street. I stay frozen where I am, still clinging to my makeshift megaphone, unable to tear my eyes away from the crowds. I lift the speaker to my lips. "People of the Republic!" I shout. "Do you hear me?" My words blare out from every speaker in the square, probably every speaker in the country for all I know. It startles me. The people below let out a cheer that makes the ground tremble. The soldiers must have gotten a hurried order from someone in Congress, because I see some of them hoist their weapons higher. A single bullet zips through the air and hits the glass, sparking as it goes. I don't move. The Elector makes a quick gesture at the guard standing with him, and they all press a hand to their ears and talk into their mics. Maybe he's telling them not to harm me. I force myself to believe it. "I wouldn't do that!" I shout in the direction that the lone bullet had come from. "Keep yourself steady." The people's cheers turn into a roar. "You don't want an uprising, do you, Congress?" "Day! Day! Day!" "Today, Congress, I give you an ultimatum." My eyes shift to the jumbotrons. "You've arrested a number of patriots for a crime you are responsible for. Release them, all of them. If you don't, I will call your people to action and you will have a revolution on your hands. But probably not the kind you were hoping for." The civilians scream out their approval. The chants continue at a feverish pitch. "People of the Republic!" They cheer me on as I continue. "Listen to me. Today, I give all of you an ultimatum." The chants go on until they realize that I've fallen silent, and then they too begin to quiet down. I hold the speaker closer. My name is Day. My voice fills the air. I fought the same injustices that you're here to protest right now. I've suffered the same things you've suffered. Like you, I've watched my friends and family die at the hands of Republic soldiers. I blink away the memories that threaten to overtake me. Keep going. I've been starved, beaten, and humiliated. I've been tortured, insulted, and suppressed. I've lived in the slums with you. I've risked my life for you. And you've risked your lives for me. We have risked our lives for our country. Not the country we live in now, but the country we hope to have. You are all, every single one of you, a hero! Joyful cheers answer me, even as guards below try in vain to bring down and arrest stragglers, while other soldiers are trying fruitlessly to disable the rewired speaker system. Congress is afraid, I realize. They're afraid of me, like they've always been. So I keep going. I tell the people what had happened to my mother and brothers, and what had happened to June. I tell them about the Patriots, and about the Senate's attempt to assassinate Andon. I hope Razor's listening to all this and seething. Throughout it all, the crowd's attention never wavers. Do you trust me? I shout. The crowd answers with a unified voice. The sea of people and their deafening roars are overwhelming. If my mother was still here, if Dad and John were here, would they be smiling up at me right now? I take a deep, shuddering breath. Finish what you came here to do. I focus on the people and on the young elector. I gather my strength. Then I say the words I never, ever thought I'd say. People of the Republic, know your enemy. Your enemy is the Republic's way of life, the laws and traditions that hold us down, the government that brought us here, the late elector, Congress. I raise my arm and point toward Andon. But the new elector is not your enemy. The people grow silent. Their eyes are forever fixed on me. You think your Congress wants to end the trials or help your families? It's a lie. I point at Andon when I say this, willing myself for the first time to trust him. The elector is young and ambitious, and he is not his father. He wants to fight for you, just as I fight for you. But first, he needs you to give him that chance. And if you put your might behind him and lift him up, he will lift us up. He will change things for us, one step at a time. He can build that country we all hope we can have. I came here tonight for you all, and for him. Do you trust me? I lift my voice. People of the Republic, do you trust me? Silence. Then, a few chants. More join in. They raise their eyes and fists to me. Their shouts ceaseless. A tide of change. Then raise your voices for your elector, as I have, and he will raise his for you! The cheers are deafening, drowning out anything and everything. The young elector keeps his eyes on me, and I realize at last that June is right. I don't want to see the Republic collapse. I want to see it change.
June. 2 days have passed, or, more precisely, 52 hours and 8 minutes have passed since Day climbed to the top of the Capitol Tower and announced his support for our elector. Whenever I close my eyes, I can still see him up there, his hair gleaming like a beacon of light against the night, his words ringing out clear and strong across the city and the country. Whenever I dream, I can feel the burn of his last kiss on my lips. The fire and fear behind his eyes. Every person in the Republic heard him that night. He gave power back to Andon, and Andon won over the country, all in one blow. This is my second day in a hospital chamber on the outskirts of Denver. The second afternoon without Day at my side. In a room several doors down, Day is undergoing the same tests, both to ensure his health and make sure the colonies didn't implant any monitoring devices in his head. He's going to be reunited with his brother at any minute. My doctor has arrived to check on my recovery, but he won't be doing it in any sort of privacy. In fact, when I study my room's ceiling, I see security cameras at every corner, broadcasting my image live to the public. The Republic is afraid to give people even the slightest sense that Day and I aren't being taken care of. A monitor on the wall shows me Day's chamber. It is the only reason I agreed to be separated from him for this long. I wish I could talk to him. As soon as they stop running x-rays and sensors on me, I'm putting on a mic.
Good morning to you, Miss Paris, my doctor says to me, as nurses dot my skin with six sensors. I mumble a greeting in return, but my attention stays on the cam footage of Day talking to his own doctor. His arms are crossed in a defiant stance, and his expression skeptical. Now and then, his attention focuses on a spot on the wall that I can't see. I wonder if he's watching me through a cam, too. My doctor notices what's distracting me and wearily answers my question before I can ask it.
You'll see him soon, Ms. Paris, okay? I promise. Now, you know the drill. Close your eyes and take a deep breath.
I bite down my frustration and do as he says. Lights flicker behind my eyelids, and then a cold, tingly sensation runs through my brain and down my spine. They put a gel-like mask over my mouth and nose. I always have to tell myself not to panic during this sequence, to fight down the claustrophobia and feeling of drowning. They're just testing me, I repeat quietly. They're testing me for any remnants of colonies' brainwashing, for mental stability, for whether or not the Elector, the Republic, can trust me fully. That's all. Hours go by. Finally, it stops, and the doctor tells me I can open my eyes again.
Well done, Paris, he says as he types something out on his notepad. Your cough may linger, but I think you've survived the worst of your illness. You can stay longer if you'd like.
He smiles at the exasperated frown on my face.
But if you'd prefer to be discharged to your new apartment, we can arrange that today as well. At any rate, the glorious Elector is anxious to speak with you before you leave here.
How is Day? I ask. It's difficult for me to keep the impatience out of my voice. When can I see him? The doctor frowns.
Didn't we just discuss this? Day will be released shortly after you. First, he'll need to see his brother.
I study his face carefully. There's a reason the doctor hesitated just now. Something about Day's recovery. I can see the subtle twitch under the doctor's facial muscles. He knows something I don't. The doctor snaps me back to reality. He drops his notepad to his side, straightens, and plants an artificial smile on his face.
Well, that's all for today. Tomorrow we'll begin your formal integration back into the Republic, with your new career assignment. The Elector will arrive in a few minutes, and you'll have some time beforehand to regain your bearings.
With that, he and the nurses take their sensors and machines and leave me alone. I sit on my bed and keep my eyes on the door. A dark red cloak is wrapped around my shoulders, but I still don't feel entirely warm in this room. By the time Andin comes in to see me, I'm shivering. He steps inside with his signature grace, wearing silent dark boots and black scarf and uniform, his curls of hair perfectly trimmed, thin-rimmed glasses sitting neatly on his nose. When he sees me, he smiles and salutes. The gesture reminds me painfully of Mateus, and I have to focus down on my feet for a few seconds to compose myself. Fortunately, he seems to think I'm bowing. Elector? I greet him. He smiles, his green eyes sweep over me.
How are you feeling, June?
I smile back. Well enough. Andin laughs a little and lowers his head. He steps closer, but he doesn't try to sit next to me on the bed. I can still see the attraction in his eyes, the way he lingers on every word I say and every move I make. Surely, he must have heard rumors by now about my relationship with Day. If he knows, though, he doesn't reveal it.
The Republic, he continues, embarrassed that I've caught him staring.
That is, the government has decided that you are fit to return to the military with your original rank intact, as an agent, here in Denver.
So I'm not going back to Los Angeles. The last I heard, L.A.'s quarantine had been lifted after Andin began an investigation into the Senate's traitors, and both Razor and Commander Jameson were arrested for treason. I can only imagine how much Jameson hates Day and me now. Even the thought of what the fury on her face must look like sends a chill down my spine.
Thank you, I say after a while. I'm very grateful.
Andin waves a hand in the air.
No need. You and Day have done me a great service.
I give him a quick, casual salute. Already Day's influence is being felt after his impromptu speech. Congress and the military obeyed Andin in allowing protesters to return unpunished to their homes, and releasing the patriots who had been arrested during the assassination attempt, under monitored conditions. If the Senate didn't fear Day before, they do now. He has the power for the time being to ignite a full-scale revolution with only a few choice words.
But,
Andin's volume drops and he pulls his hand out of his pockets to cross them in front of his chest.
I have a different proposition for you. I think you deserve a more important position than agent.
A memory surfaces of when I was on that train with him, of the unspoken offer hanging on his lips. What kind of position? For the first time, he decides to sit down with me on the edge of my bed. He's so close now that I can feel the light whisper of his breath on my skin and see the stubble shadowing his chin.
June. He begins. The Republic has never been more unstable than it is now. Day brought it back from the brink of collapse, but I'm still ruling during dangerous times. Many of the senators are battling for control amongst themselves, and many people in the country are hoping for me to make a wrong move.
Andin falls silent for a second.
One moment won't keep me in the people's favor forever, and I can't hold the country together alone.
I know he's telling the truth. I can see the exhaustion in his face and the frustration that comes with being responsible for his country.
When my father was a young elector, he and my mother ruled together, the elector and his princeps. He was never more powerful than he was during that time. I'd like an ally too, someone smart and strong, whom I can trust with more power than anyone else in Congress.
My breathing turns shallow as I take in the offer he's circling around.
I want a partner who has her finger on the pulse of the people, someone extraordinarily talented at everything she does, and someone who shares my ideas about how to create a nation. Of course, one couldn't go from agent to princeps in the blink of an eye. One would need intense training, instruction, and education, an opportunity to grow into the position over the course of many years, decades, to first learn as a senator, and then as the Senate's leader. This is not training to bestow lightly, especially upon someone without Senate experience. Of course, there would be other princeps elects shadowing me as well.
He pauses here. His tone shifts.
What do you think?
I shake my head, still not quite sure of what exactly Andin is offering. There's the chance to be the princeps, a position second only to the elector. I would spend almost every waking moment of my life in Andin's company, shadowing his every step for at least 10 years. I would never see Day. This offer makes the life I'd imagined with him waver unsteadily. Is Andin offering this promotion purely based on what he thinks of my capabilities? Or is he letting his emotions influence him, promoting me in the hopes that he might get a chance to spend more time with me? And how can I possibly compete with other potential princeps elects, some of whom will probably be decades my senior, perhaps already senators? I take a deep breath, then try to ask him in a diplomatic way. Elector, I begin. I don't think...
I won't pressure you.
He interrupts, then swallows and smiles hesitantly.
You are absolutely free to turn this down. And you can be a princeps without...
Is Andin blushing? You don't have to, he says instead. The Republic, would only be grateful if you did.
I don't know if I have that kind of talent, I say. You need someone so much better than I could ever be.
Andin takes both of my hands in his. You were born to shake the Republic. June, there is no one better.
Day. The doctors didn't like me in the beginning. The feeling was pretty mutual, of course. I haven't exactly had the best experiences in hospitals. 2 days ago, when they finally managed to get me off the balcony of Denver's Capitol Tower and calm the massive throngs of people cheering me on, they strapped me into an ambulance and took me straight to the hospital. There, I shattered a doctor's glasses and kicked over my room's metal trays when they tried to check me for injuries. You put a hand on me, I'd snapped at them, and I'll break your gaudy necks. The hospital staff had to tie me down. I screamed myself hoarse for Eden, demanding to see him, threatening to burn down the entire hospital if they didn't deliver him. I shouted for June. I yelled for proof that the Patriots were released. I asked to see Kaede's body, begging them to give her a proper burial. They broadcasted my reactions live to the public because of the crowds that had gathered by the hospital, demanding to see I was being treated properly. But gradually I calmed down, and after seeing me alive, the crowds in Denver began to calm down too. Now, this doesn't mean you won't be closely watched, my doctor says as I'm given a set of Republic collar shirts and military trousers. He mumbles so the security cameras can't pick up what he's saying. I can barely see his eyes through the glare across his tiny round glasses. But you've been fully pardoned by the Elector, and your brother Eden should be arriving at the hospital any minute now. I'm quiet. After everything that's happened since Eden was first stricken by the plague, I can barely comprehend that the Republic is going to give him back to me. All I can do is smile at the doctor through gritted teeth. He smiles back at me with an expression full of dislike as he goes on about my test results and where I'm going to live after all this is over. I know he doesn't want to be here, but he doesn't say it out loud, not with all these cameras on. From the corner of my eye, I can see the one monitor on the wall that shows me what they're doing to June. She appears safe, undergoing the same inspections as me. But the anxiety in my throat refuses to go away. There's one last thing I'd like to tell you in private, the doctor goes on. I listen half-heartedly. Quite important. Something we've discovered in your x-rays that you should know about. I lean forward to hear him better. But at that instant, the room's intercom blares to life. Eden Batar Wing is here, doctor, it says. Please inform Day. Eden. Eden is here. Suddenly, I couldn't care less about whatever my gaudy x-ray results are. Eden is outside, right beyond my cell's door. The doctor tries to tell me something, but I just push past him, throw the door open, and stumble out into the corridor. At first, I don't see him. There are too many nurses wandering through the halls. Then I notice the small figure swinging his legs on one of the hall's benches, his skin healthy, and his head full of wayward, white blonde curls, dressed in an overly large school uniform and kid-sized boots. He seems taller, but maybe that's because he's able to sit up straighter now. When he turns toward me, I realize that he's wearing a thick pair of black-rimmed glasses. His eyes are a light, milky purple, reminiscent of the young boy I'd seen in the rail car on that cold, sleet-filled night. Eden, I call out hoarsely. His eyes stay unfocused, but an amazing smile blooms on his face. He gets up and tries to walk toward me, but he stops when he can't seem to tell where exactly I am.
Is that you, Daniel?
He says with shaky hesitation. I run to him, scoop him up in my arms, and hold him tight.
Yeah,
I whisper. It's Daniel. Eden just cries. Sobs rack his body. He tightens his arms around my neck so fiercely that I don't think he'll ever let go. I take a deep breath to contain my own tears. The plague has taken most of his vision, but he's here, alive and well, strong enough to walk and talk. That's enough for me. Good to see you again, kid, I choke out, ruffling his hair with one hand. Missed you. I don't know how long we stay there. Minutes? Hours? But it doesn't matter. Time ticks by one long second after another, and I make the moment stretch out as much as I can. It's as if I'm standing here and hugging my entire family. He is everything that means anything. At least I have this. I hear a cough behind me. "Day?" the doctor says. He's leaning against the open door of my cell, his face grave and shadowy under the fluorescent light. I gently put Eden down, keeping one hand on his shoulder. "Come with me, this will be quick, I promise. He pauses at the sight of Eden. "I recommend you keep your brother out here, just for now. I assure you that you'll be back in a few minutes, and then you'll both be driven to your new apartment." I stay where I am, unwilling to trust him. "I promise," he says again. "If I'm lying, well, you have enough power to ask the Elector to arrest me for it." Well, that's basically true. I wait a while longer, chewing on the inside of my cheek, and then I pat Eden's head. "I'll be right back, okay? Stay on the bench. Don't go anywhere. If someone tries to make you move, you scream. Got it?" Eden wipes a hand across his nose and nods. I guide him back to the bench, then follow the doctor into my cell. He shuts the door with a soft click. "What is it?" I say impatiently. My eyes can't stop turning toward the door, like it'll vanish into the wall if I don't stay vigilant. Against the corner wall, June's monitor shows her waiting alone in her room. But the doctor doesn't seem annoyed with me this time. He clicks a button on the wall and mutters something about turning the sound off on the cameras. "Like I was saying before you left, as part of your tests we scanned your brain to see if it had been altered by the colonies. We didn't find anything to worry about, but we ran across something else." He turns around, clicks a small device, and points to an illuminated screen on the wall. It's displaying an image of my brain. I frown at it, unable to make sense of what I'm seeing. The doctor points to a dark splotch near the bottom of the image. "We saw this near your left hippocampus. We think it's old, probably years old, and has been slowly worsening over time." I puzzle over it for a while, then turn back to the doctor. It still seems trivial to me, especially when Eden is waiting out in the hall, especially when I'll be able to see June again. "And? What else?" "Have you had any severe headaches? Lately or within the last few years?" "Yes. Of course I have. I've had headaches ever since the night that the Los Angeles Central Hospital ran tests on me. The night I was supposed to die, when I ran away." I nod. He folds his arms. "Our records show that you had been experimented on after you failed your trial. There were some tests conducted on your brain. He coughs, struggling for the right words. "You were meant to succumb rather quickly, but you survived. Well, it seems that the effects have finally started catching up to you." He switches to a low whisper. "Nobody knows about this. Not even the Elector. We don't want the country to be thrown back into a revolutionary state. Initially, we thought that we could cure it with a combination of surgery and medication. But when we studied the problem areas closer, we realized that everything is so entwined with healthy matter in your hippocampus that it would be impossible to stabilize the situation without severely impairing your cognitive capacity." I swallow hard. "So, what does that mean?" The doctor removes his glasses with a sigh. "It means, Day, that you're dying."
June. 20:07 hours. 2 days since my release. Oxford High-Rise, Lodo Sector, Denver. 72 degrees Fahrenheit inside. Day was released yesterday at 7 a.m. I'd called him 3 times since then, each time with no answer. It wasn't until a couple of hours ago that I finally heard his voice over my earpiece. "Are you free today, June?" I'd shivered at the softness of his voice. "Mind if I stop by? I want to talk to you." "Come on over," I'd replied. And that was pretty much all we said to each other. He'll be here soon. I'm embarrassed to admit that even though I tried busying myself for the last hour by tidying the apartment and brushing Ollie's coat, all I can really think about is what Day wants to discuss. It's strange to have a living space that's my own again, furnished with myriad new and unfamiliar things. Sleek couches, elaborate chandeliers, glass tables, hardwood floors, luxurious items that I no longer feel entirely comfortable owning. Outside my window, a light spring snow falls. Ollie sleeps beside me on one of the two sofas. After my release from the hospital, soldiers escorted me by jeep here to the Oxford high-rise, and the first thing I saw when I stepped inside was Ollie, his tail wagging like crazy, his nose pushing eagerly into my hand. They told me the Elector had long ago requested that my dog be sent to Denver and taken care of, right after Thomas had arrested me. Now they've returned him, this small piece of Mateus, to me. I wonder what Thomas thinks of all this. Will he just follow protocol as always and bow the next time he sees me, pledging his undying loyalty? Maybe Anden has ordered his arrest, alongside those of Commander Jameson and Razor. I can't decide how that would make me feel. Yesterday they buried Kayade. They would have given her a cremation and a tiny plain marking on the wall of a funeral tower, but I insisted on something nicer. A real plot, a square foot of her own space. Anden, of course, obliged. If Kayade were still alive, where would she be? Would the Republic have eventually inducted her into their Air Force? Has Dave visited her gravesite yet? Does he blame himself for her death, as I blame myself? Is this perhaps why he's waited so long after his hospital release to contact me? What happens now? Where do we go from here? 12 hours. Days late. I keep my eyes glued to the door, unable to do anything else, afraid I'll miss him if I blink. 15 hours. A soft bell echoes through the apartment. Ollie stirs, perks up his ears, and whines. He's here. I practically leap off the couch. Day is so light on his feet that even my dog can't hear him walking down the hall outside. I open the door, then freeze. The hello I'd prepared halts in my throat. Day is standing before me, hands in his pockets, breathtaking in a brand new Republic uniform. Black with dark gray stripes running down the sides of his trousers and around the bottoms of his sleeves. A thick diagonal collar on his military coat that's cut in the style of Denver's Capitol troops. And elegant white neoprene gloves that I can see peeking out from his trouser pockets, each decorated with a thin gold chain. His hair spills past his shoulders in a shining sheet and is sprinkled with the delicate spring snow falling outside. His eyes are bright, startlingly blue and lovely. A few snowflakes glimmer on the long lashes that fringe them. I can hardly bear the sight. Only now do I realize that I've never actually seen him dressed up in any kind of formal attire, let alone formal soldier attire. I hadn't thought to prepare myself for a vision like this, for what his beauty might look like under circumstances that would actually show it off. Day notices my expression and offers me a wry grin.
It was for a quick photo, he says, pointing at his outfit. Of me shaking hands with the Elector. Not my choice, obviously. I better not regret throwing my support behind this guy.
Evaded the crowds gathered outside your place? I finally say. I compose myself long enough to quirk my lips into a returned smile.
Rumor has it that people are calling for you to be the new Elector.
He scowls in exasperation and makes a grumpy sound.
Day for Elector? Right. I don't even like the Republic yet. That'll take some getting used to. Now, the evading I can do. I'd rather not face people right now.
I hear a hint of sadness there, something that tells me he did indeed visit Kayade's grave. He clears his throat when he notices me studying him, then hands me a small velvet box. There's a polite distance in his gesture that puzzles me.
Picked it up on my way here. For you, sweetheart.
A small murmur of surprise escapes me. Thanks. I take the box gingerly, admiring it for a moment, and then tilt my head at him. What's the occasion? Day tucks his hair behind one ear and tries to appear uncaring.
Just thought it looked pretty.
I open the box carefully, then take a sharp breath when I see what's inside. A silver chain with a small teardrop-shaped ruby pendant, bordered with tiny diamonds. 3 slender silver wires are wrapped around the ruby itself.
It's gorgeous, I say. My cheeks burn. This must have been so expensive.
Since when did I start using cordial social niceties when talking to Day?
He shakes his head.
Apparently the Republic is throwing money at me to keep me happy.
Ruby's your birthstone, yeah?
Well, I just figured you should have a nicer keepsake from me than a ring made out of gaudy paperclips.
He pats Ollie on the head, then makes a show of admiring my apartment.
Nice place. A lot like mine.
Day's been given a similar heavily guarded apartment a couple of blocks down the same street.
Thank you, I say again, gingerly setting the box on my kitchen counter for the time being. Then I wink at him. I still liked my paperclip ring best, though.
For a split second, happiness crosses his face. I want to throw my arms around him and pull his lips to my own, but there's a weight in his posture that makes me feel like I should keep my distance. I venture a hesitant guess at what's bothering him. How's Eden?
He's doing well enough.
Day gazes around the room one more time, then lets his eyes settle on me again.
All things considered, of course.
I lower my head. I'm sorry to hear about his vision.
He's alive.
Day cuts me off gently.
I'm happy enough about that.
I nod in awkward agreement, and we lapse into a long pause. Finally, I say, you wanted to talk?
Yes.
Day looks down, fidgets with his gloves, then shoves his hands into his pockets.
I heard about the promotion Andon offered you.
I turn away and sit on my couch. It hasn't even been 48 hours, and already I've seen the news pop up twice on the city's jumbotrons.
Juniperus, tap to train for Princeps position.
I should be happy that Day's the one who brought it up. I'd been trying to figure out a good way to approach the subject, and now I don't have to. Still, my pulse quickens, and I find myself feeling as nervous as I feared. Maybe he's upset that I didn't mention it right away? How much have you already heard? I ask as he comes over to sit beside me. His knee gently grazes my thigh. Even this light touch sends butterflies dancing in my stomach. I glance at his face to see if he did it on purpose, but Day's lips are drawn into an uncomfortable line, as if he knows where he's going to take this conversation, but doesn't want to do it.
I heard through the grapevine that you'd have to shadow Andon's every step. Yeah? You'd train to become his princeps? That all true?
I sigh, slump my shoulders, and let my head sink into my hands. Hearing Day say this makes me feel the gravity of the commitment I'd have to make. Of course I understand the practical reasons why Andon would tap me for this. I hope I am someone who can help transform the Republic. All of my military training, everything Mateus ever told me. I know I'm a good fit for the Republic's government, but... Yes, all true, I reply, then add hastily. It's not a marriage proposal, nothing like that. It's a professional position, and I'd be one of several competing for the position, but it'd mean weeks, well, months away at a time, away from you, I want to say, but it sounds too cheesy, and I decide not to finish the sentence. Instead, I give him all the details that have been running through my mind. I tell him about the grueling schedule of a princeps elect, how I'd planned to give myself breathing room if I were to agree to it all, that I'm unsure of how much of myself I want to give to the Republic. After a while, I know I've started rambling, but it feels so good to get everything off my chest, to bear my troubles to the boy I care about, that I don't try to stop myself. If anyone in my life deserves to hear everything, it's Day. I don't know what to tell Andon, I finish. He hasn't pressured me, but I need to give him an answer soon. Day doesn't reply. My flood of words hangs in the silence between us. I can't describe the emotion on his face. Something lost? Something ripped from his gaze and strewn across the floor? A deep, quiet sadness that tears me apart. What's going through Day's mind? Does he believe me? Does he think, like I did when I first heard it, that Andon is offering this because of a personal interest in me? Is he sad because it would mean 10 years of barely seeing each other? I watch him and wait, trying to anticipate what he'll say.
Of course he's going to be unhappy with the idea. Of course he'll protest. I'm not happy myself with...
Day suddenly